Welcome back, everyone. We're diving deep today into some of those moments in the Synoptic Gospels where Jesus, gets into some pretty heated debates. You know those passages I'm talking about, right?
Oh, absolutely.
We're going to unpack these controversy passages, as Dr. Robert C. Newman calls them, with help from, a lecture by him, the good doctor himself, a biblical scholar. Ever just feel lost trying to figure out, what's the point of these exchanges, you know?
I think we've all been there.
We're going to try to unlock the secrets to understanding them a little better today, taking into account things like the historical context and maybe even how some of those arguments back then will challenge how we see things today.
These exchanges, some of them are straight up stories, narratives, and others are kind of woven into his teachings, and they show us so much more than what Jesus said, right?
Huh?
It's like we get a glimpse into how he actually thought, how he put together these arguments, and also the pushback. You know, the opposition he got from people in his own time. Not everyone was on board with this message, that's for sure.
That's so true. And I think a lot of us today, we read these passages and we're like, wait, what? You know, it's easy to read them through our 21st century lens and try to, apply them directly to today's hot topics.
Right.
But we're missing a huge piece of the puzzle.
Yeah.
You can't understand a conversation if you don't understand, what led up to it.
Yeah.
So let's talk about that historical backdrop for a minute. Could you maybe explain why understanding the historical context is so important for us?
It's like you're trying to do a jigsaw puzzle, but half the pieces are missing. We need that context to see the complete image, to see all the different shades of meaning. For instance, you know, Jesus was dealing with debates that were very specific to his time and place. They might not be the same ones that we're, you know, super focused on today. It's kind of like the new perspective on Paul debate. Sometimes our own, modern concerns and baggage can cloud our ability to really grasp what the original text meant, you know, to those who first heard it.
Yeah, it's easy to project our own ideas onto these ancient texts without even realizing it. So Dr. Newman, he gives us some really helpful questions to keep in mind when we approach these passages. He says we should always ask ourselves, who are Jesus' opponents? What makes them tick? What do they believe?
Mm.
And also, what are their motivations for challenging Jesus?
Exactly. And I think that last question is crucial because it goes deeper than just disagreeing with Jesus' theology. It's about power dynamics. It's about social and religious hierarchies. Remember, the religious landscape in Jesus's time was pretty complex.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
You had different sects, different schools of thought, and they were all, you know, vying for influence and authority.
It was a power struggle, basically.
Right. So challenging Jesus, for some of these folks, it might have been a way to assert their own authority, you know, to try to discredit him in front of the crowds.
It makes you wonder, how scared were people to speak up against religious leaders back then?
Well, there was definitely a lot of respect for authority, but at the same time, there was also this tradition of debate and questioning.
So they weren't all just blindly following along.
Not at all, especially in a place like Jerusalem, which was this melting pot of ideas and beliefs. So we've got these opponents, right? And Jesus isn't just throwing down pronouncements. He's engaging them in a real debate, which is really interesting. I mean, what can we learn from how Jesus argues his points, especially since his audience didn't necessarily accept everything he said as, you know, gospel truth? That's what makes it so fascinating. Jesus was a master communicator. He tailored his arguments to his audience.
Yeah.
He used logic. He appealed to their shared scriptures. He even used a bit of irony to get his points across. But Dr. Newman points out something that's really important. There are often missing steps in these arguments. Things that would have been obvious to people back then, you know, they were steeped in that culture. But for us, they might fly right over our heads. It's kind of like if you walked into a room and everyone's having this intense conversation, but you missed the beginning, you're not going to fully understand what's going on.
Right. Can you give us an example of something specific that might trip us up as modern readers?
Okay, so think about it. Jesus is talking to people who have grown up with the Jewish scriptures. I mean, they know these stories inside and out. They're familiar with centuries of traditions and interpretations. So we might read a passage where Jesus quotes a prophet and think, oh, okay, got it. But to his audience, that quote might evoke a whole world of meaning,
cool. A
specific historical event or a big theological debate that we're completely clueless about.
That's a really good point.
Yeah.
Okay, so we've got this framework for understanding those controversy passages, the importance of historical context. Now, Dr. Newman, he focuses on one particular story to illustrate this, and it's a good one. It's the story of Jesus casting out a demon And then he gets accused of using the power of Beelzebub. You can find this in Luke chapter 11, starting at verse 14. Now, this story has always fascinated me. I don't know about you.
Oh, it's a classic. A classic sure. example of how his opponents try to discredit him. And it also highlights, like, the brilliance of how Jesus responds.
Yeah.
But before we get into that, let's just pause for a second and think about that accusation itself.
Yeah.
Who is this Beelzebub character? I mean, ruler of demons doesn't exactly sound like a friendly dude, does it?
No, not at all.
Dr. Newman explains that the name Beelzebub is probably a mashup of a couple of words. You got Baal, which means Lord, and then you have Zebul, which could mean, well, it has a few possible meanings, actually. It could be filth. It could be Lord of the Dwelling. It could even be a prince. So we're definitely in the realm of something powerful and definitely connected to the demonic.
So is Beelzebub just another name for Satan, or are we talking about one of his, like, top lieutenants?
That's the thing. The text itself isn't totally clear on that point. Dr. Newman says we can't definitively say if it's like a direct synonym for Satan or if it's one of his, you know, high-ranking demons. But what is crystal clear is that Jesus's opponents are accusing him of using evil power. And that, you know, back in their culture, that was a seriously bad thing. That was a huge accusation.
It was like the ultimate smear campaign.
Yeah.
Like, they couldn't deny the miracles, so they tried to, like, twist the narrative, you know, claim that his power came from a dark source. They were trying to neutralize him by associating him with evil.
Exactly. And that raises such an interesting question. What was their real motivation?
Yeah.
I mean, were they genuinely concerned about demonic activity, or was this just a calculated move to try to take Jesus down a peg?
I mean, it could be both, right?
Oh, definitely. Dr. Newman suggests it's probably a mix of both, you know, a genuine fear of the demonic mixed with some good old-fashioned political maneuvering.
A little bit of everything.
Right. So how does Jesus respond to this serious accusation?
Yeah, like, what does he do?
Well, he basically takes it apart piece by piece with these incredibly clever arguments. Dr. Newman breaks them all down, and it's really fascinating. Like, he uses logic, he appeals to their own beliefs, and he even throws in a little bit of irony just to expose, like, how flawed their thinking is.
So give us the play-by-play. How does he dismantle this accusation point by point?
All right, so first he uses logic. He's like, okay, can Satan really afford to fight against himself?
That makes sense.
Right. Like, if Satan is at war with God, it wouldn't make sense for him to sabotage his own efforts by casting out demons.
That's a really powerful image. It's like saying a political party can't win an election if it's constantly, like, infighting.
Precisely. And that's how Jesus makes his point so effectively. He uses an analogy that his audience would have immediately understood.
Yeah.
And then he turns the tables on them a bit. He says, if I'm casting out demons by Beelzebub, then by whom are your sons casting them out?
Right. Okay. What's he getting at there?
He's pointing out that the Pharisees, they practiced exorcisms too.
Oh, I see.
He's implying, hey, if my methods are demonic, then yours must be too. It's subtle, but very effective. It highlights that inconsistency in their argument.
He's calling them out on their own hypocrisy. I love it.
All right. And then Jesus takes it up a notch. He declares, if I'm casting out demons by the finger of God, then the kingdom of God has come upon you.
Now, that's where things get really theological. He's linking his exorcisms to the arrival of God's kingdom. What's the significance of that phrase, finger of God?
Ah, good question. Dr. Newman points out that this phrase echoes back to Exodus chapter 8, where, remember those Egyptian magicians? They couldn't replicate the plague of gnats that God sent through Moses. They even admitted, like, this is the finger of God.
Wow, okay.
They recognize God's power at work. So Jesus, he's drawing a parallel. His miracle, like those plagues, demonstrate God's power and the arrival of his kingdom. Have you ever had, like, those moments in your life where something happens and you're like, whoa, that was a clear sign. That was the finger of God.
Oh, totally. Like, it makes you stop and think. So I'm seeing how it all connects.
Yeah.
Jesus isn't just defending himself. He's using this exchange to reveal who he is and what he's all about.
Yes, exactly. And he drives that point home with a powerful image, the parable of the strong man. He compares himself to, like, a stronger man who overpowers another strong man guarding his house, you know, takes his weapons and plunders his belongings.
Okay, now, isn't that analogy a bit violent?
It might seem that way to us, but remember, people in Jesus's time, they were used to a more, agrarian and even militaristic worldview.
Right. Yeah.
The image of a strong man defending his property would have made perfect sense to them. It might seem a bit harsh to us, but to them, it conveyed that reality of, like, this is spiritual warfare. This is serious business.
That's a really helpful way to look at it. So in this analogy, Jesus is the stronger man and Satan is the one being overpowered.
Exactly. Jesus is showing that he's more powerful than Satan and he's come to liberate those who are like held captive by those demonic forces.
Wow, that's a powerful picture of the spiritual battle that's going on.
It is. And then Jesus makes this very clear statement. He says, "He who is not with me is against me, and he who is not gathering with me is scattering." Like, he's drawing a line in the sand, right? You're either on God's side or you're siding with the forces of darkness.
It's a call to choose sides, to take a stand.
Exactly. But then he throws in this curveball. He tells this parable about an unclean spirit who leaves a man. And then later, that spirit comes back and the man's house is all swept and in order, but it's empty. So the spirit brings seven other spirits even worse than himself, and the man's condition ends up way worse than it was before.
Okay, now this is where I get a little lost. How does that parable connect to what he was just saying?
Right. It's a head-scratcher, isn't it? Dr. Newman says this parable, it's puzzling, but he suggests that it's a warning about what happens when someone experiences deliverance from demonic influence, but they don't fill that empty space, that void, with something stronger and more lasting.
So it's not enough to just be, like, cleansed or freed from evil.
Mm.
You have to actively cultivate a relationship with God to prevent those forces from coming back.
That seems to be the message here. And it ties back to his earlier statement about the kingdom of God coming upon them.
Right.
Jesus offers more than just freedom from demons. He's inviting them into a new reality, a new way of being in relationship with God.
I'm starting to see how it all fits together.
Mm.
But then there's another twist.
Oh, yeah.
A woman in the crowd, she shouts out, "Blessed is the womb that bore you and the breasts you sucked." It seems like she's trying to, like, praise Jesus by praising his mother.
It's an interesting interruption.
Right.
It might seem like a total distraction from the main point, but Jesus, he actually uses it to teach another profound truth. He responds, "On the contrary, blessed are those who hear the word of God and keep it."
So he's shifting the focus from, like, physical lineage to spiritual connection.
Mm-hmm.
It's not about being related to Jesus in the flesh, but about hearing and obeying God's word.
Exactly. It challenges our assumptions about privilege, you know, and where true blessing comes from.
Yeah.
It's not about who your parents are or your social standing. It's about aligning your heart and your actions with God's will.
There's so much packed into this one exchange. It's like we've only just scratched the surface.
We have. There's so much more to unpack here. Well, there really is, like, layers and layers. And Dr. Newman's analysis, it helps us connect all those pieces that seem a little random at first, you know?
Yeah.
Like, you got the accusation, those logical arguments back and forth, then that parable, the woman interrupting, and somehow Jesus, he manages to weave it all together. It's like he's making a huge statement about, well, his authority, the nature of God's kingdom, and just how crucial genuine obedience is.
It's like he's taking this one controversy, right, and using it to explore all these deeper truths.
Exactly. That's what makes these controversy passages so rewarding to study. It's not just about, you know, winning a debate. It's about really uncovering God's truth, like wrestling with what it means for our lives.
Let's maybe pause for a second, recap what we've covered so far.
Okay.
We talked about why that historical context is key, those essential questions to ask when we're reading these passages.
Yeah.
And then we walked through that whole Beelzebub controversy step by step.
Yep.
So what would you say are some of the biggest takeaways from this deep dive so far?
Well, first of all, we got to remember that Jesus, he wasn't debating, like, abstract theological ideas, you know, just up in the clouds somewhere.
Mm-hmm.
He was dealing with real life controversies. With real people, people who had their own, you know, agendas and motivations.
Yeah, these weren't hypothetical arguments.
Right.
Right. These were high stakes encounters. Like, they could have real consequences.
Absolutely. They were playing for keeps. And the second thing, we see how those arguments Jesus uses, they draw so deeply from those Jewish scriptures.
Yeah.
He uses, like, familiar images and stories and concepts, but he kind of flips the script to reveal this whole new perspective.
It's like he's speaking their language, but then he's like subverting their expectations.
Right. So. Exactly. And third, I think it's really important to note that Jesus, he isn't afraid to challenge our assumptions.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, his responses to his opponents and even to that woman who interrupts him, they force us to confront our own biases. You know, those preconceived ideas we all carry around.
That's so true. It's easy to read these passages and be like, yeah, Jesus, you tell him. But honestly, if we're really being honest with ourselves, we might find that we're actually holding on to some of the same arguments that he's dismantling.
It's like holding up a mirror, isn't it?
Yeah.
They pull us into this conversation with Jesus, and it can be uncomfortable, but it also leads us to a much deeper understanding of ourselves and of God's truth.
Now, Dr. Newman makes a really important point at the end of his lecture. He says these arguments, they highlight just how important it is to use sound judgment, to avoid bias, to be fair with the evidence.
That's huge.
Yeah,
it's like a timeless principle, you know? It goes way beyond biblical interpretation. It applies to, like, everything in life. I mean, we live in a world where it's so easy to get trapped in these echo chambers.
Oh, I know.
Surrounded by information that only confirms what we already believe, right? But these passages, they challenge us to do something different, to engage with different viewpoints,
yeah,
to really weigh the evidence, to be open to the possibility that we might be wrong.
That's where the real growth happens.
Yeah, I think so.
When we're willing to step outside that comfort zone.
Exactly. To wrestle with those tough questions.
So what does all this mean for us, you know, as we go about our everyday lives? How can we apply these insights from Dr. Newman's lecture? Like, beyond just understanding these specific texts, these biblical texts.
That's the million-dollar question, isn't it?
Yeah, it is.
There's no, like, one-size-fits-all answer, but there are definitely some key principles we can glean from all this. First, we need to cultivate humility.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
We got to recognize that we don't have all the answers.
Right.
Our perspectives are limited, and we can learn a lot from other people.
It's that whole strong opinions loosely held thing.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. Like being willing to change your mind when you're presented with new information or a different perspective.
Which can be so hard to do sometimes.
Yes, it is. The second principle is engaging with those difficult topics, but doing it with like a spirit of charity. We need to assume the best about people who disagree with us, to really listen to what they have to say, and to look for common ground whenever possible.
That's tough.
It is, especially in today's world where it's like so easy to demonize anyone who thinks differently than you do.
Oh, I know. Social media makes it even worse.
It does. It really does. But these passages, I think they remind us that even Jesus, like the embodiment of truth and love, he engaged with his opponents in a respectful way.
Yeah.
He didn't just like resort to insults or personal attacks.
Right.
He addressed their arguments like head on, with logic and compassion.
Even when he's being sharp and witty, he's still doing it in service of something bigger, you know?
Yes.
He's not trying to win points. He's not trying to dominate the debate. It's like he's trying to open people's minds and hearts to God's kingdom.
That's beautiful. I think that's the ultimate goal we should be aiming for in our own conversations, especially those conversations about controversial topics.
Yeah.
We should approach those conversations with humility, with charity, and with a genuine desire to understand the other person's perspective, even if we end up disagreeing.
So it's not about like avoiding those tough conversations or pretending disagreements don't exist. It's about engaging in those conversations truthfully but lovingly.
Exactly. And that's, well, it's a challenge, but it's a challenge worth embracing. It's not always easy, but it's essential if we want to really live out the values that Jesus modeled for us.
This is so inspiring.
Yeah.
But I also feel like we need to unpack some of this even more. Like, there's so much to explore here.
I agree. And we have another segment to dive even deeper into this.
All right. So we've talked about these controversy passages, these hidden treasures in the Gospels. They're full of insights, right? But they can also be pretty challenging, especially when we're trying to like bridge that gap between our modern world and the world Jesus lived in. So how do we do that? Like, how do we actually take that historical context into account when we're reading these passages?
That is the question, isn't it? And I think it's something that anyone who's serious about understanding, well, any text, not just the Bible, really needs to grapple with. Dr. Newman, he reminds us that these Gospels, they weren't written in a vacuum. They were written within a specific culture with specific beliefs, you know, religious beliefs and even political tensions. And all of that, it shapes the meaning of the words, like it shapes the arguments, even the assumptions that the original audience would have had.
So it's more than just like looking up word definitions or reading a quick summary of what life was like back then, right?
It's so much more than that. It's about immersing ourselves in that world, you know, as much as we can.
Okay.
It's about grasping those social structures, the religious beliefs, even the political climate of the time. Imagine trying to understand a political debate today without knowing anything about the candidates, the parties, the current events. Like, you'd be totally lost.
Right. You'd miss so much of the nuance. It's like we're trying to become time travelers, right? Stepping back into that world and trying to see things through the eyes of those people who like first heard Jesus's words.
That's a great way to put it. And the more we understand that world, the more those nuances will like jump out at us from the text. And the good news is there are so many resources out there to help us on that journey.
Oh, good.
Commentaries, historical studies, even archaeological findings.
That sounds amazing, but also a little intimidating.
I know, right? It's a lot.
Like, where do we even start?
Just start with curiosity.
Okay.
Pick a passage that intrigues you, you know, something that really grabs your attention, and then really, like, dig into the details, read the verses around it, look up those historical or cultural references, check out some commentaries. They'll offer different perspectives. Ask yourself, who are the key players here? What are they trying to accomplish? What's at stake in this whole exchange?
I'm guessing the goal isn't to find, like, the definitive answer.
No, not necessarily.
It's more about, like, opening ourselves up to a deeper understanding of the text and, like, all its complexities.
Exactly. And that deeper understanding, it's going to enrich our own lives. I really believe that. The more we immerse ourselves in the world of the Gospels, the more we can appreciate just how revolutionary Jesus's message really was.
Yeah.
The opposition he faced, the courage he showed, speaking truth to a world that, well, a lot of times rejected it.
It makes you wonder, as we're wrestling with those ancient controversies, do you think we become better equipped to deal with the controversies and challenges we face in our own lives today?
I think so. I mean, that's the amazing thing about these texts, right? They were written centuries ago, but they speak to us today. It's like they're timeless. They invite us into this conversation about faith and truth and how we, like, live out our values in a world that really needs them.
That's a really good point. This deep dive into these controversy passages has been, well, eye-opening, to say the least. I feel like I've gained a whole new appreciation for just how deep and how complex the Gospels are. I'm definitely going to be reading them with fresh eyes from now on.
It's been a pleasure exploring this with you.
Likewise.
And to all our listeners, I hope you'll dive into these passages for yourselves, you know, do your own deep dive. You might be surprised at what you discover.
That's great advice. Thanks for joining us for this deep dive. And until next time, keep seeking. Keep questioning and keep uncovering those hidden treasures within the scriptures.